Sorry, we're just having some technical difficulties with the...
Is this the last one?
No.
I'm good.
It's a long term this time. We're going to change the topic in the middle, but we're good for now. Okay, so this is week 5 of... You were good? Yvonne, you ready?
Yes.
Good.
She's socializing.
I understand. It's good. We're going to talk about socializing soon. So this is week 5 of the series that we're doing called Making Anxiety Work For You, based on the book Thriving With Anxiety with Dr. David Rosmarin. Just a quick review from last week. So we talked about the human experience being based on connections, which require what we called knowledge and awareness, which leads to empathy and so on. The good news was that even if you have a deficiency in that area, good traits can be learned, can be studied, can be mastered. We discussed at length the idea of the brain ruling the heart. And we cited a study that people who go through challenge, things like anxiety or other challenging experience, actually have more awareness and notice more and tend to have better empathy and understanding and awareness of others. Although there can be what we call a compassion collapse, when a person gets sucked into the temptation of victimhood. And the way we stay away from that is to assume responsibility, even though we might not be at fault for something, but it's ours. It's ours, we own it. It's our problem and we need to take care of it. We need to address it and confront it and work through it. Then we spoke about the whole thing of people watching, which is to learn the art of every day, actually consciously noticing and trying to understand where people are at, what they're feeling, what they're doing, what their needs are, and so on and so forth. Okay, so before we start today, just a couple of reminders. First of all, this coming Wednesday evening, we're going to be doing another home discussion, a home shiur at Shelley's home, called Don't Pursue Happiness, which, of course, is a strange topic, but that's okay. It'll be a discussion on happiness. That's this coming Wednesday night at 7:30 for 7:45, right?
No, it's
7:15 for 7:30, sorry. Don't worry, I would have looked at the thing before I came. I'll be on time. That's this coming Wednesday night. Also, just put in your diary, I mentioned it last week. I sent it out in the WhatsApp. So if you didn't get it, please let me know. Purim morning, put in your diary, Sunday morning, 24th of March. I think it's 10:15 at Ariella's Breeders' Home in Vaucluse. A Purim hour, as we do every year. So don't miss it. Purim is only one day. So important to experience it, at least a little bit. So Sunday, 24th of March. Okay. And lots of other things happening, which are all on the WhatsApps, the emails, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and so on. Okay. I'm mentioning that because we're actually building up our YouTube channel now. We have someone, you probably noticed, we have someone new in the office, Josh, who's also working on our marketing and our social media and building up our YouTube channels. We actually have now 2 YouTube channels, one called Beit Midrash, one called Bina Living, which is like the type of stuff we do here. The meditations, all the things are going to be on there. So it's becoming more and more accessible, all the learning. Okay. So today we look at chapter 5 in the book, where the author of the book actually veers a little bit. And this particular discussion is actually not so much about anxiety, although we're going to use it. It's more about relationships, actually. Because he started this discussion about how sometimes the experience of anxiety and noticing it at the beginning and being aware of it and using it out for the positive and channeling its strengths can actually help us in our relationships, as we talked about last week. But he highlights 2 things. He highlights, first of all, some critical concepts when we look at strong and healthy and effective relationships. And he shows how we can use some of those concepts that we discussed in the last few weeks about anxiety to improve and strengthen those relationships. So as I said, it's more of a discussion on relationships today, but we're going to use some of the concepts that we discussed about anxiety. We've talked about relationships often, but we haven't revisited it for a while, so this is actually a good time to do it. Okay. So he begins with kind of a foundational concept, a few foundational concepts. First of all, as a reminder, as we spoke about last week, that we are social animals. Right? It's even hard to stop socializing when the shiur begins, right? So we are social people. we actually need each other. That's the way the world works, right? We need each other. We thrive with each other, and we strengthen each other, inspire each other. So that's an opportunity, because as we said, we can actually, last week we discussed, we can use our anxiety to become more aware, because anxious people are super aware. And therefore, if we know how to do that, know how to use it and harness it, we can actually use it to become more aware and understanding of other people. But on the other hand, it can create a problem, being anxious, because when we tense and we don't channel it properly, the very fact that no one is perfect can be a problem. And in relationships, we need to know that no one is perfect. That's just a foundational rule, right? And we need to navigate that. And the question is, what do we do when we come into contact, when we enter into a relationship and we suddenly realize limitations, imperfections, struggles, or even flaws that other people have? How do we do that, right? Because what we'll see is, and we'll discuss a lot, is that navigating healthy relationships requires that we make peace or accept or thrive with the limitations and even deficiencies of other people. And sometimes our anxiety can actually exacerbate that, but if we use it properly, we can actually use it out to the fullest. So let's just talk about that for a moment, about this concept that everyone is. See, in the past, we've talked about differences. And let me just begin with something I've shared with you a number of times, but it's been a number of years, I think, since I shared it. So let me just share it again. And that's the famous Rachel and Leah, Rachel and Leah concept, if you remember. So we've always said that when we enter into relationships, normally what happens is people enter into relationships because of sameness, right? Compatibility. We find sameness with the other. But actually, as we've talked about many times, that's why relationships happen. But relationships thrive because of difference, not because of sameness. Right? That's how relationships thrive. Specifically, as the Talmud says, that just as people, no two people look alike, no two people think alike, we can actually grow from that difference. And we've talked a lot about difference. Sometimes that difference is hard because there's a different perspective to ours, a different opinion, different ways of looking at things, different, it seems like it's wrong and all that kind of stuff, right? So we have the famous Rachel and Leah idea, which comes, and I once heard this as an explanation about the famous Bardechen ceremony that takes place at a wedding, right? So everyone always says that the source of the veiling the bride at a wedding goes back to the biblical story of Jacob, when he married two wives, Rachel and Leah. And the origin of that is because he actually wanted to marry Rachel, who was Leah's sister. And he had a father-in-law that was a con man, essentially. And Leah was slightly older. So at the last minute, when they were bringing in the bride in those days, the way it was done, it was dark and couldn't see. He actually brought in Leah. And then the way the verse reads, Vayhi baboker, it was the next morning, Vehinehi Leah, and behold, it's Leah, it's not Rachel, right? And he was upset. He asked his father-in-law, what's this all about? So he said, well, you know, we can't marry off the younger before the older. But don't worry, he says, you worked for 7 years in order to marry Rachel. Let's finish the week. You'll marry Rachel. This time I'll do you won't have to work before. You can marry Rachel too, and then you can work another 7 years for Rachel, and everything's fine. Okay, that's what he did. So the saying goes that the reason that we veil the bride is we bring the chatam, we bring the groom into the room where the bride is, so he can check out it's the right person, right? Before he goes to the chuppah, make sure it's the right bride. The problem with that explanation is that it's the opposite. In other words, then we should be uncovering the bride, not covering, right? We should be unveiling, not veiling. And in fact, what the chatan does, what the groom does when he walks into the room, he actually covers the bride. How does that fit symbolically with this idea that he's actually checking out that it's the right person? So I once heard a very beautiful explanation. And then it's like this. We learn Kabbalistically, and we learn in Kabbalah about Rachel and Leah, that actually, although in this biblical story, there are two separate people, but actually they're two parts of every person. And the reason for that is because we learn that Rachel was a very uncomplicated, very smooth, very hopeful, very optimistic person, right? Just like... And part of the reason was because And Leah wasn't. Leah actually was more sad. She was much more of a complicated person. The background to that story was actually because there was a... They were related to Jacob's family. And the background was that there was the rumor that went around for years that Lavan has two daughters and Yitzchak has two sons, Jacob and Esau. Esau wasn't a good guy. And what's going to happen, the plan is that Leah, the older one, is going to marry Esav and Rachel is going to marry Yaakov. That was the going rumor over the years. And actually that traumatized Leah because she didn't want to marry Esav, of course, because Esav was not a good guy. And because of that, it says her eyes were very soft from crying, and just generally the idea of Leah represents something that's much more complex than Rachel is. Now, we all have a Rachel and Leah. Right? That's how it works. We all have the parts of us that are uncomplicated. We hope that that's the bigger part, but not always. And things that go well, things that are simple, things that work according to expectations, uncomplicated, simple, smooth, and so on. But we also have the layer. Everyone has a layer. The complicated parts, our insecurities, our complicated relationships, our whatever it is, our rough parts of our personality, right? That's the symbolic layer of every single person. And the story of Yaakov marrying Rachel and Leah is really the story of every relationship, right? It's the story that you marry, or not only marriage, but any relationship. You enter into a relationship because you want to have a Rachel. That's what you want to have. Everyone wants to have that. You don't enter into a relationship because, you know, yes, it's going to be a really complicated relationship, and I'm sure I can grow from it and all that kind of stuff. No one does that. Everyone looks for the Rachel. That's what you find, and that's the relationship you enter into, supposedly, right? And then the Torah tells us, "Vayhi baboker," was the next day, symbolically meaning over time, suddenly you realize, you discover, hey, one second, it's not just a Rachel. Right? There's a layer here too. It's not easy. There is a layer, right? Okay. So, But if you understand how relationships work, you actually discover, yes, there's a layer, because you know what? I'm not the only one. Everyone has a layer. And I need to learn to navigate that. Not only do I learn to navigate that, I need to learn to grow from it and strengthen from it and be non-judgmental about it and work through it, right? And that's the symbolism, at least according to some commentary, behind the veiling of the bride. When the chatan walks in, what he sees in front of him is a Rachel. But he commits to the whole person. That's why he covers the bride. To say that, listen, I know I'm marrying what I see, I'm marrying a Rachel, but actually I'm committing to what I don't see as well. I'm committing to the... It's a commitment to the entire relationship. It's a commitment to the layer as well. That's why the chatan covers the bride, acknowledging that there's stuff behind what he sees, behind the obvious, behind the smoothness, because everyone has a layer, and he's committed to the layer and the racha. Right? That's the idea. Now, that can happen on two levels. What we've often talked about is more the idea of difference, right? That no two people look alike. And that's hard enough, because difference means that every person is different. Every person looks at things differently. Every person has different perspectives, different views of the world. Even if we enter into a relationship where the values are aligned, but that's fine, that's an important thing. But even when values are aligned, that doesn't mean that we look at things the same way. There are many, many things, different ways to express the same values. There are many, many different ways to implement the same values, and everyone is just different. Every person is unique, right? Not wrong or right, just unique. Not good or bad, just different. And that's difficult enough for relationships to be able to navigate that and to realize, because by design, we all have a bit of an ego, and we all believe that the way we look at the world is the way it's supposed to be. Our perspective of how we implement our values and communicate our values is the way I think it should happen. And therefore, it's very difficult, especially if it's a very deep relationship, to come to terms with the fact that actually there's different ways of implementing, right? This is a challenge in marriage, for example. It's a challenge in parenting. It's a challenge, right? I always tell people relationships, and particularly parenting actually, is the greatest form of personal growth, right? When I give parenting classes, I say it's not just about learning strategies about how to deal with your kids and how to get them to do what you want them to do. It's actually learning how you should grow, right? How maybe you're not to come to the realization you're not raising clones, right? You're raising different people. And no matter how many children you have, every child is different. Even if they all end up living by the same value system that you wanted to communicate to, which is the way it's supposed to, you know, we hope it's going to be, doesn't matter. They're each going to live it in a very different way, right? And that's hard. So it's a lot of personal growth. But the truth is, it's more than just differences. And this is, I think, the point he makes in the book, right? It's actually we discover not just differences, but deficiencies. Why? Because we're not perfect. And guess what? The other person's also not perfect, right? Now, there's an interesting verse that says, "En tzaddik ba'aretz asher ya'aseh tov v'lo yechata," which means there's no righteous person that exists on earth that is completely righteous and will never sin. Yechata. Everyone transgresses. But in Kabbalah, they teach it's just not about transgression. It's also about lacking. The word chet in Hebrew can mean transgression. It could also mean chisaron, like a lacking, a deficiency. Because everyone lacks things. Everyone is limited in some ways, right? So when we enter into a relationship with someone, it's not just about the differences that we have, which are both good and both right, just different. It's actually the things that we see that we don't like, right? It's just deficiencies, imperfections, limitations, which will also be there. And it's up to us to know how to accept them, how to live with them, how to work it through, and so on and so forth, right? In that verse that I mentioned, the intention of that verse is more about the relationship between us and God. And it's about God's understanding of us, right? That he realizes that we're limited and we have deficiencies and he puts up with it. But it's not just about God, it's about to each other as well. We have to be like God, right? We have to learn from him. If he can tolerate it, we need to learn to tolerate it. Particularly that we are also people and we also have the same, different imperfections maybe. Which is why, and I think I've mentioned this once before as well, there's a fascinating passage in Pirkei Avot, in the Ethics of the Fathers, that talks about not judging people, right? And it says we should always learn to judge people favorably. And how do we do that? So it says, we have to look at the language very carefully. It's in Hebrew, I'll try and sort of communicate it clearly. It says, "Havidanet kala adam," we should judge everyone, "lekaf schut." Essentially, it means favorably, right? So you should judge every person favorably. But if you look at the language carefully, it doesn't actually say that exactly. That's why it's always translated, but it's actually not accurate. That's why translation is such a complicated thing, right? When you translate from one language to another, a lot often gets lost in translation. Because you translate by context, but often there's deeper stuff there, particularly in Hebrew. So it doesn't actually say judge everyone. In Hebrew, you would say judge everyone, you would say hevedan kol adam. Kol adam means every person, right? But it doesn't say that. It says, judge kol ha'adam, which means the whole person. It doesn't mean every person, it means the whole person. Ha'adam means the person. Kol ha'adam means the entirety of ha'adam, the person. That's what it actually means. And the commentaries explain a beautiful thing, because how do we judge someone favorably? There's two ways. You see, sometimes people do things that seem very wrong, and we rush to a judgment, right? But sometimes our judgment is completely wrong, so we've misinterpreted the experience, right? We might not know the background, we might not know the context, we might not know the intention of the person, correct? So that's one way. You judge favorably by saying, well, maybe I don't know the background. You know, I didn't get invited to someone. Well, maybe the invitation was sent, it just got lost in the mail, right? Or went to junk mail nowadays, right? Okay, that's one way of judging favorably. Always to think of maybe there's a different way of looking at it. Maybe I'm missing part of the fact, and therefore I'm misinterpreting. That says Pirkei Avot, there's a different way of judging favorably, and that is that maybe you're not misinterpreting it. Like maybe the thing that you see is just so clear cut wrong. It's just wrong. However, says the passage, Havedan et kol ha'adam, judge the whole person. You're looking at one component of a person, that no one's perfect. So they did something wrong. Okay, made a mistake. So do you. But look at that. When you want to judge favorably, look at kol ha'adam. Look at the whole person. Notice the good they do. Notice the strengths they have, the entirety they have, the wonderful contribution they make. When you start looking at Kol Ha'adam, then you're able to judge favorably, even though they have a flaw, even though they made a mistake. If you just focus on the error, if you focus on the thing that was done, yes, you're going to judge harshly. But if you focus on Kol Ha'adam, the entire person, then it's a different story. Incidentally, it's not so related to what we're talking about, but just an interesting thing. In the Ethics of the Fathers, that particular passage is right next to the phrase that you should make for yourself a mentor. Right? And I once looked at that. It's interesting. Why? What's the connection between judging favorably and making a mentor? Because the truth is, it's just mentorship also. You know, sometimes we choose someone to follow. We choose someone who's, you know, we trust and is authentic and sincere and so forth. But no one's perfect, even a mentor. Right? Like, you know, sometimes people choose leaders and they want their leaders to be absolutely perfect. Well, no one's perfect. So even leaders will make mistakes. I mean, obviously, it depends on what context, depends how much, and so on, right? So the Pirkei Avot says, you know, before I tell you, you have to choose for yourself a mentor. Yeah, choose someone that's got values, that you can trust, that's got leadership, and so on. But remember, even that person, you're going to have to look at Kol Ha'adam. Even that person, you might have judged favorably. Because no one's going to be mistake-free, right? It's just interesting how it comes together. Okay. Now, the problem with all this is that we live in a society, as he points out in the book, where actually this is going the opposite direction. It's all very nice talk, but it's going the opposite direction. I mean, you see this in very, very many parts of life, right? He quotes, I don't know these people, but he quotes someone from a movie star from some more conservative back way in the 1960s, and he said about President Kennedy when he was elected, he said, I didn't vote for him, but he's my president, and I hope he does a good job, right? That kind of talk you don't find today anymore, in politics, for sure, right? Everyone's either amazingly good, when it's not true, it was never true, or everyone's just amazingly evil, completely evil, right? That's the way it's going, and that's the direction it's taking. And it filters down not only for politicians, I'm mentioning politicians only because that's the leadership of the world, unfortunately, but it kind of filters down. It filters down to everyone. When people becoming more and more stuck, and people don't want to recognize that people have imperfections, and want people to fit into their worldview completely, and if they don't, they're completely evil. So it's become a very extreme and polarized society where everyone is either, I love that person or I can't stand it, right? Which, of course, doesn't do very well for relationships. Because, as we said before, all of our relationships are with people who are not perfect. It's just the way it is, right? And, you know, I'll just quote what he says here in the book. He says, I've seen plenty of wonderful marriages, he's a therapist for many years, between individuals who are vastly different from each other. Some unions survive and even thrive, because over time, each member of the couple learns to make peace with the other's idiosyncrasies and limitations, right? Now, we know, of course, that this idea that everyone is imperfect, but at the same time, everyone is good, is a very Jewish idea. We learn that everyone is created, B'tzelem Elokim, everyone is created in the image of God, right? And I'm not talking about even close relationships, but even just basic respect for all human beings. We just need to look at people with respect. We just need to understand that every person, every member of society has something you can learn from, has something to contribute, because they have a godly spark within. Okay, there are a few unique individuals where maybe it's completely buried and completely hidden. We always talk about that. But essentially, everyone, even people I disagree with vehemently, have what to offer, have what to contribute, right? So just a good mindset to get used to, because it filters down then into serious relationships that we have, right? And that respect for other people, by the way, can be, just to go off to a tangent for a second, it can be expressed in many different ways. You know, there's differences and there's complete disagreements, but either way there can be respect. Either way we can see good in other people. What I mean by that is as follows, right? So when we enter relationships with people that have the same values as us and they implement them differently, so then it's not a matter of wrong or right, it's just a matter of different, and we need to get used to that and learn from the difference. There are cases, however, and I think this is what society doesn't understand, that there are people that disagree in values, and that's okay too. Now, I wouldn't recommend people enter into very deep relationships with people of different values, because values are good to have common values. That's healthy for any relationship, right? like marriages and things like that. Always, it's good when people can align their values. It doesn't have to always be that way, but when the basic values of life are the same, it's a good thing, right? But if someone who has different values than me, it's okay for me to think they're wrong. That's fine. And at the same time, to get on with them and to have respect for them, which is not the way the world is going at the moment, right? On either side of people's values, right? They are, because values are important. We've spoken about this once before. The reason why it's okay to disagree with someone, you know, people talk about tolerance today, talk about respect. So there's this distorted notion that respect is only when you agree with the person. If you don't agree with them, it means you're not respecting me. That's totally not true. Why? Because it's actually good to disagree with people, even vehemently. Why do I say that? Because values are a really important part of life, right? Values are it's the guiding principles of life. And what is the definition of a value? The definition of a value is that it's my conviction. It's something I deeply believe in, right? I deeply believe in my values. And so I should. So should everyone. Now, everyone takes their values from different places, whatever the case is, but right? But values are something you deeply believe in, which means that someone who doesn't agree with you is actually wrong in your view, and that's fine, right? It happens, you know, in the way we implement Judaism, the way we believe in Judaism, and so on and so forth. Are people cold here? Okay. We're putting it off. Put it off until people start to schwitz, then we'll put it back on again. How's that? We'll do this in shifts. Right? I mean, I'm open with this example, so I'll give it to you. Even in Judaism, part of my value is Orthodox Judaism, which means that I believe the Torah was given at Sinai, and that's where we got get our guiding principles from. Now, within Orthodoxy, there's different ways of expressing that, and that's fine. So it's what we call the 13 principles of faith from the Rambam, who set down the 13 core principles of faith. It's the song of Yigdal people sing in Shul on Friday night. That Torah from Sinai, there's only one God, and we only pray to one God, and we believe in the ultimate coming of Mashiach, and so on and so forth, right? These are the core principles that all Orthodox communities adhere to, and implement them differently within the realms of Orthodoxy and Halakha, and so on and so forth, and that's fine, there's plenty of respect. But there are parts of our communities within Judaism that don't believe in the 13 principles of faith, right? There are other non-Orthodox communities that don't believe in the same principles. They don't believe the Torah was given at Sinai in the same way Orthodox does. And I'm very clear about that. I think they're wrong. They're completely wrong. Not that's an option. I don't think that, you know, maybe I'm right, maybe they're right. I don't think so. I think my belief in God is completely right, and that belief is completely wrong. But it doesn't take away from my respect. I don't think they're less of a human being because of that. Right? And I think that's okay to completely disagree with someone on a value level, and yet to believe that they're a contributing member of society, they do have a lot of good, they believe they are created in the image of God, and there's a lot of good that they do. Even though I disagree with them, that's fine. That's not the popular view in society at the moment, right? You know, if you take the right and left, or the different views in society on all different issues, it's a very common thing. If you don't agree with me, you're bad, right? And that's where it all breaks down. So from a Jewish point of view, this idea that no one's perfect, no one's all time right, and even where it was legitimately okay to believe someone is wrong. I'm not talking about the different, if it's just different ways of implementing the same thing, then we have to learn to respect that and learn to understand there's just different ways of implementing the same thing. But even when you really believe the other person is wrong, it doesn't matter. Everyone's got some good. Ha'adam, the whole person. The whole person is not bad, God forbid, right? And you can talk to them, and you can socialize with them, you can drink coffee with them, and you can learn from them in different issues which don't relate to the convictions that you have. Now, part of why that's so problematic today, right? Part of why this is so difficult today for people to experience goes back to what we spoke about a few weeks ago. That because we live a comfortable lifestyle, we have gotten into a pattern. The world has gotten into a pattern. Society has gotten into a pattern where life needs to be easy. That's what it is. We don't like discomfort, right? Therefore, because life is supposed to be easy, so relationships are supposed to be easy. People assume that relationships are going to be easy, especially when they start off really good, right? And therefore, dealing with imperfect people, flawed people, different people, actually makes us anxious. We get upset, right? So there's relationship anxiety. Part of our anxiety comes not from ourselves, but comes through relationships, when things are starting to become uncomfortable. So this is the connection, right? So as soon as we realize, we recognize, and we discover imperfections with other people, it induces, especially if you're prone to anxiety anyway, it induces anxious feelings, right? The problem with that is that it's all a made-up thing, meaning it's all an error, it's erroneous thinking, right? A lot of anxiety comes from thinking, comes from misfire of the brain, as we called it, right? Because we're all imperfect, and no relationship is easy, and no relationship is perfect. And all relationships take work, something we've mentioned many, many times. A thriving relationship does not come without work, no relationship. If anyone tells you they've had years of a perfect relationship without work, it's not true. It's just simply not true. That's right.
In the movies.
In Hollywood, that happens. Correct. Exactly.
In the movies, yeah.
Right? We're just all different. We have biases. We have subjectivity. We have whatever. Essentially, right? And what happens, unfortunately, today is that instead of putting in the work, what do people do? By and large, they chuck it out. Or, even worse, because they don't realize, another problem is they don't realize how important that work is. Because going back to what we said last week, connection is so important. Connection is fundamentally important. So if you chuck away connection because you value comfort, or like we said last week, we have a society that values productivity more than connection, that's where it all starts to break down. And what's happening even more than that is that not only are people disposing of relationships much quicker nowadays than they used to, as soon as it gets a little bit uncomfortable, right? Now, that doesn't, as I've said many times, whenever I talk about this, it's important to understand that sometimes relationships do need to come to an end. Right? That's just clear, right? For many reasons, we'll talk about this soon, but not always. And they're coming to an end far too quickly today and far too early because there's just not a willingness to actually put in the work. More than that, what's happening, if you look at the studies, if you look at the stats, actually people are not even, first of all, like the divorce rate or relationship breakdown rate is sky high these days. And second of all, what's actually even worse is that people are not committing to relationships altogether. And if you notice, if you looked at the statistics, marriage is completely down, like dramatically down in the world, right? I once gave a talk. I do this talk sometimes for young people, young adults, and I give them the option of choosing the topic, which is sometimes a bit risky. Right? So we had a discussion. I said, just choose stuff, whatever you want. So they came back. The topic is, why is marriage important? I said, oh, that's a bit... Right? And I sat down and I said the following. I mean, it was a long talk, so I won't give you the whole thing now, but I said, listen, I'm a rabbi, right? So I don't know what you guys are expecting, but I mean, obviously, from a religious point of view, marriage is important because you can't have sex without marriage from a purely religious view, right? So you can't actually live together and have children or even enjoy life without it. But I said, that's not what I'm going to say tonight, right? That's not what I came here to tell you. I mean, I was had to be honest. But I talk about it because it's not just a spiritual difference, right? I spoke about, of course, the spiritual differences. When two people get married, there's a chuppah, there's souls connect. What happens? Like, what's different if you've been living together for 3 years? What's different now when you just got married? You stood under chuppah. What changed? Okay, it's a lot of spiritual changes that happen, right? True. The souls connect to each other, the soulmates and the journey to the souls from the creation of the world, all these things are all true. But I said, that's not my point tonight. My point is that actually marriage is crucially important in today's society. And the reason that's not happening is not only because people don't believe in the spiritual concept, is because what changes the day you get married is commitment. That's what changes. And people don't want to commit. You know why? Because what does commitment mean? And this is, I think, the crux of it. Commitment means that I've just committed to go beyond myself. Right? In other words, as long as I stay in a relationship, even if it's for a few years, but I'm not committed, so that I'm still reserve the right. Right? I reserve the right. If it's not going my way, good, so we'll break up. Not a problem. It's not a big issue. We never committed, so it's not a problem. Right? As soon as we go through a marriage ceremony, even if it's a civil marriage ceremony, right? What you've just done is you've committed. And commitment is hard to break. And now people don't want to commit. Why? Because commitment means I'm committed to this for the long term. I'm committed to this even if it doesn't feel comfortable sometimes. I'm committed to put in work. I'm committed to go beyond myself. And people don't want to go beyond themselves. Because we live in a very me world, as we've talked about many times. But if you want relationships to happen, if you want connection to happen, we need to be committed to go beyond ourselves. That's why marriage is important, right? I don't know if it helped, but that's what I said. Anyway, but, so what do we do that? So, but it is difficult sometimes, right? So what do we actually do? So we have to turn it around. As we spoke about last week, when we have anxiety, nothing to do with relationships, we catch it early. So there's two, we talked about, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the two journeys. The spiral of anxiety or the spiral upwards, in other words, right? Like we get the trigger, and then the question is, what do we do about it? So the same thing happens with anxiety that's relationship based. Number one, when we get anxious, we become aware that no one's perfect. So we become more empathetic, like we spoke about last week. But it's more than that. When we discover imperfections, and that makes us feel uncomfortable in the relationships. Now we're talking about anxiety that happens in a relationship. We get tense, we get upset. It'll happen in every relationship. Our question we have to ask ourselves now, what am I going to do with that anxiety? Right? Now, just like we spoke about in the beginning, the natural tendency is that anxiety gets worse. Why does it get worse? Because we become incredibly uncomfortable with the anxiety. We're scared of the anxiety, right? And therefore, it just gets worse. So we go to catastrophic thinking, and then we just spiral out of control, right? As we spoke about a few weeks ago. But if we view the anxiety as just general anxiety, if we view it as a misfire of the brain, as we said, right? As a smoke alarm that's reminding us to do a bit of work. We accept it. We take it on board, and then we confront it, and we work with it. Then we can actually make it work for us, and we can make it thrive with us, right? And exactly the same thing is in relationships. So when people enter into relationships, and then suddenly there's imperfection, suddenly there's things that I can't stand, I don't like, I'm getting upset with, right? It's a signal. It's nothing wrong. Nothing happened. It's a signal from the brain that things have just gotten uncomfortable. Things have just changed. There's a warning sign. By the way, you're living with someone that's not perfect.
But after you're not married, you can run away.
And then you want to have connection. That's the point. That's why commitment is very important. That's what I'm saying, right? It's not about just marriage, by the way. It's any relationship, right? But I'm saying marriage is always a symbol of a deep relationship, right? But you know, from a Jewish point of view also, we know that when something happens, it happens for a reason, right? So again, like we spoke about the very first week, we get very, very upset. Something happened that seems negative, so we get overwhelmed. But the question we have to ask ourselves is, why is this happening? And what can I do about it? And how can I give it meaning? How can I give it purpose, right? In other words, instead of quashing the anxiety, as he says in the book, we need to address whatever is causing it to manifest. What are we gonna address? What are we going to do with it, right? So the first thing we need to do, as soon as we get the warning, the key is to catch it early. Because if we don't catch it early, it will, just like regular anxiety, will go out of control. Same thing in relationships. If I don't catch it really early, it will just spiral completely out of control. And one of two things will happen, as we'll soon explain. The first thing to do is to give up control. Part of anxiety in relationship happens is because we like to control the world, right? This is true in everything. We just like to control. Control means that everything needs to go the way I think it needs to go. And suddenly when I see flaws in other people that really I can't control, that's anxiety inducing, and it makes us really anxious. So the first step in everything in life, but especially in relationships, is when you're in a relationship, remember that there's an other. And that you don't control this relationship because you don't control the world. Because you don't control anything, really. You just control yourself. Right? As we've discussed many times. Second of all, we need to remember that it happens for a reason. Everything happens for a reason. And there's a message here. Like just we spoke about in anxiety, it's a smoke alarm, it's a misfire of the brain, but it happens for a reason. It's a reminder. It's a reminder to become stronger. It's a reminder to harness the energy. It's a reminder to do something with it that you could do that might make it work and might make the relationship stronger, actually, if you do it right. Now, again, accepting the flaws in someone else and giving up control obviously has its limitations. God forbid if it's an abusive relationship, if it's a very disrespectful relationship, if there's no cooperation as much as you try to get out of the other person, you know, there are times that relationships come to an end for a reason. That's why the Torah gives that option. We know that from Jewish, right? It's a sad thing, but nevertheless, the Torah says there's an option for it, right? That's why we have our idea of divorce in Torah. And that's a symbol for all relationships. Not all friendships have to last forever, not all friendships, all these things, right? So, but it doesn't mean it has to be as disposable as they are today, right? And then we have to be conscious of the two spirals. So there's one thing called the disconnection spiral. What happens is something happens, right? So we feel anxious. Someone said something. Someone did something. So what do we do that's wrong, which will take us into a point of no return? Next step is we catastrophize, right? I'm not appreciated. I'm not respected. I'm looked down upon. I'm always used. You know, we start to use the term always. You always, right? Very, very bad expression to use. You always. And when you say you always, that's very accusatory. When you become accusatory in a relationship, you just get it back. And it becomes a dance of anger, right? So it doesn't work. You always, you never, always, never, all these things, right? There's absolutely nothing wrong, as we've talked about many times. There's nothing wrong in having a hard conversation. There's nothing wrong in telling someone, just technical problems. Nothing wrong in sharing with someone that particular thing, actually, I'm not sure, maybe you didn't mean that, but actually it was hurtful. That's okay. When we start catastrophizing, you always, never do this. You never appreciate me. You never buy me. You never do this. You never do that. That's just taking the anxiety of the recognition of the imperfection and taking it to a level of catastrophizing it, right? Then, of course, what do we do after we catastrophize? We have these catastrophic feelings of how we just take it out of proportion and it's absolutely terrible. What do we do next? We start to blame. Blaming has two components. This is what he explains. It was very well explained here. Right? It has two components. Either we blame the other person, but sometimes actually not about the other person. We start to blame ourselves. I should never have done this. I should have seen this. Maybe it's my fault and all that kind of thing. Both are very unhealthy and both don't work, right? And then it just gets very messy. And then what happens is, so there's the initial anxiety, which comes from the recognition of imperfection. There's the catastrophic thinking. Then we blame, and then it just spirals out of control. And then eventually it leads to relationship breakdown. So therefore, what he suggests is we need to turn that around, right? We need to embrace and embark on the connection spiral. What's the connection spiral? The connection spiral means, first of all, we have to view that initial anxiety, initial upsetness as a blessing. It's a very different perspective, right? So in a relationship, something happens, hurtful. Some imperfection is highlighted. You feel upset, you feel anxious. His point is, you feel anxious, see it as a gift. It's a smoke alarm. Without catastrophizing, see it as a gift. It's a warning sign to do some work. It's a reminder that effort is needed. And embrace that, right? And it doesn't mean that we are completely broken. It doesn't mean that it's a point of no return. It just means that we have been reminded that work is needed. So what do? We have to recognize that there are imperfections. We have to know this is normal. We have to know that nothing happened. It's fine. And we have to embark on the connection spiral. What is the connection spiral? So it starts off the same as the disconnection spiral. There's the trigger. What happens afterwards is totally different. rather than going into catastrophic thinking, we have to then, first of all, accept imperfection, right? First rule. I see this is a pattern I didn't know existed. I see that person's always late, or they, they're not as tidy as I am, or whatever. They tend to have a different way of communicating things, right? So you can work with it, but you also have to accept that it just might stay, right? Because the worst thing to do in any relationship is to think you can change the other person. So there has to be an acceptance of that. But acceptance of that in place of catastrophic thinking. The person is, it's not about he never do and they never care about me and I couldn't care less and all that kind of stuff. It's not about that. It's about a flaw that they have that is different to mine. And they probably have the same problem. They're just recognizing flaws that I have, which they didn't discover either, right? Which is fine. So we accept the imperfection. As soon as we do that, it's a whole different ballgame. Okay, then we have to know what we're going to do about it. We have to communicate it. We have to recognize. We have to be honest with each other. All that stuff. But it removes that catastrophic thinking that will just spiral into complete breakdown. Right? Part of that accepting the flaws is actually to have compassion. Compassion to ourselves. It's okay for me to feel anxious about it. It's normal. I don't have to blame myself. Compassion for the other. No one's perfect. I just discovered I didn't marry or enter into a relationship with Mr. or Mrs. Perfect. Right? And then once I'm in that mode, then we can communicate respectfully. Then we can reduce the disconnection and enhance the connection, right? And that's how the two spirals work. But the point is that actually both journeys, whether it's the spiral of disconnection or the spiral of connection, actually start the same way, just like with anxiety in general. It starts the same way. It starts with a feeling of anxiety, a feeling of being anxious, a feeling of being upset. And it's up to us what we do with this. And this is the point, this is the whole point throughout the book. It's up to us how you're going to see it. Are you going to be scared of it? Are you going to look at it as a terrible accident, a terrible thing that just happened to you? And therefore just move into much more catastrophic mindset and it'll just spiral out of control? Or you actually, while it's still small, you're going to see it as a blessing. You're going to see it as a misfire of the brain and a reminder from the brain that work is needed. And if you see it that way, and you see it as just a reminder that work is needed, then you can remove the catastrophic thinking, you can move into much better thinking, you can have compassion, you can have acceptance, and then you can work with it. Now, work with it can look, it depends what the flaw is. Sometimes it needs intervention, sometimes it needs a lot of work, sometimes it needs a little bit of work, but at least there's a respectful way of working to it. Incidentally, he doesn't talk about this, but I'd like to add just because it's something I've come across, unfortunately, recently a lot, just in talking to people and helping people. You know, when you accept it and you work with it, even if it's very severe, and you know what, even if it lands up in a relationship breakdown, but even breakdowns have different ways of playing out. I know it's not totally connected to a topic, but it's something that's on my mind because I've seen it just recently happen, and it's very sad. You know, marriages, for example, sometimes come to an end, but sometimes comes to an end with young children involved. And when it comes to an end very badly, it just looks, it's like crazy. I deal with people sometimes. Recently, I've had this experience more than once. And then just dealing with people, I just want to shake both of them up and say, you know, can you just, like, you've gone your separate ways. Just, you have kids, like, worry about them. Yeah. Right? Just stop being so self-absorbed. Stop being so into yourself and insisting on being right. It's just like this self-absorption and this commitment and this obsession. On both sides sometimes, of being right. But no, I'm going to show them. You're killing your kids, right? So I want to say that sometimes even this concept of actually doing the work, even if it doesn't work at the end, right? In severe cases, in extreme cases. And even, as we said, some relationships have to come to an end. But even that is two ways of what's happening. And come to an end in kind of better ways than others. And it's just very sad when it doesn't. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. Just about, because the only people that can do something about it are the people involved. And sometimes only one person, sometimes both people. It's just very, very sad.
And can I make a point?
Yeah, please.
I will just ask a
question. Yes, yeah, sure.
I often think in marriages, if people do the work, they can make it work. So if one person won't do the work and it doesn't work, then how often at the back end of that, it's going to be as you described? Because if you've got one person prepared to do the work and one person that doesn't,
Correct. So I think that, no, that's 100% correct. I mean, sometimes that's the reason for a breakdown, and it's the reason for a bad breakdown too. Because the person that refuses to do the work, they're not going to do the work later either.
No,
they didn't do it in the marriage. They won't do it after the marriage, right? But sometimes, and there's two ways that can play out. Sometimes when one person thinks they're doing the work, often doing the work correctly can inspire someone else to do the work, and that does happen. You know, someone's lagging behind, but they get there eventually, but sometimes not. But if both people are trying, which sometimes happens, it doesn't mean always it's going to work, that's what I'm saying. It's not what we're saying now. I mean, it's yes, when you start early and you accept imperfections, and basically people are compatible people, just everyone's not perfect, and they're both ready to do work, then there's a good chance it's going to really not only work out, but actually thrive. But when that doesn't happen, if they're ready to do work, even if it's like, I mean, sometimes you just have mismatch to begin with, right? But they're both ready to put in the work, then they'll put in the work at the end also. And you see those, unfortunately, now rare cases where we actually, there's a breakdown, there's a divorce, but it's amicable, to some degree at least, right? Where they have someone else's interest in mind, like the kids, and don't destroy their lives, right? But not always, and it's very, very sad. So, but just getting back to a happier, on a happier note, by looking at these things earlier and seeing it as a blessing when you get anxious to them, often the differences are not that big, they just spiral out of control because, and that does happen a lot, because of the spiral of disconnection. And if we can see it early and recognize it as a blessing, we can do, and prepare to do the work. This is what it is. It's all about being prepared to do the work. I think life today boils down to a few principles, and one of them is we have to prepare to work. Life is not a dream. People in the old shtetl knew that. We don't know that, and we need to learn that, and we need to be prepared to work hard. There's more to come. We'll probably do another week or two on this topic, and then we'll do another series.